Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dosey, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Tom Britton, co-founder at Syndicate Room. Tom is also a NED with the UK Business Angel Association. He holds an MBA from Cambridge and is also a product management blogger. So we're really excited to have Tom on the show today. Welcome, Tom.
Welcome.
How's it going today?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Apparently 12 months of Zooming and I still haven't figured it out.
Takes a bit of practice. So no worries there. But listen, let's kick off the show and maybe we can go back in time a bit and look at the early part of your career and discuss how that has helped you succeed at Syndicate Room. Because I do know that you have had a number of different types of careers along your journey.
Yeah, it's quite a diverse career in many ways. So I grew up in Los Angeles, California. My mother is like third generation Los Angelian, which is not unheard of, but you know, our family had been there since Los Angeles really started to grow as a city. And my dad was born and raised in Edinburgh in Scotland. And he moved out to the States to travel around a little bit and to teach and to coach football, soccer, and tennis, funnily enough. And one summer he came out to do that and he just decided to drive cross country. So he was in New York, drove across to LA, realized that he loved it there because the weather was always nice compared to Edinburgh, which is beautiful, but quite rainy. And so he just stayed. So he eventually met my mom and the rest is history. And I was born there with my sister and my brother. But we grew up playing football, playing soccer in LA. And when I got to university, I played a bit. When I got done with the university, I didn't feel like I was done with that part of my life. So I decided to move to Edinburgh, you know, going back the way to try and make it as a professional athlete. Mm. And I played for a few years in Scotland. So I was with a team called Berwick Rangers, a team called Newton Grange Star, and had fun doing that for 4 years, but it wasn't really well paid by any means. And so everyone, you know, all the people that I was playing with there, we all had other jobs outside of that. I kind of got lucky that my second passion was technology. And I found a job working for a company called Trainline at the time. So they do train ticketing and they manage the software for most of the train systems in the UK. So Virgin Trains and GNER and all of those. And so I was a product manager at the Trainline, getting to live my best life, also playing part-time professional football. Long story short, I really enjoyed working for the Trainline and being a part of the startup and scale-up culture. And there came a point in time where they were deciding to sell the business. And I thought, you know, having been involved for a long time, that I might get to share in that a little bit. But lo and behold, when I joined, it was as a contractor because I was playing football and also working for them. So I didn't actually have any shares in the business. And not that I feel cheated or anything, but it was kind of a surprise when some people did quite well out of that. And I was like, you know, got a pat on the back. So I decided to leave and do my MBA because being American, you know, I was like, I'm going to start my own business. I need an MBA. And yeah, that isn't true, but at the time I thought it was what I had to do. And so I went to Cambridge, the Judge Business School. And while I was there, I met Gonzalo. And Gonzalo was the co-founder of Syndicate Room. It was really his idea initially to try and create a platform to let people invest into angel-led deals. And I really liked the concept for it because it was quasi-venture capital, getting to see all these different startups and working with them and trying to be, you know, part of their story and helping them fundraise. So when I got done with the MBA, I joined Syndicate Room as the co-founder. So a little bit of luck along the way, to be honest. And I kind of fell into a number of things, but from footballer to product manager to, I'll call myself a venture capitalist now, but it's not the typical form of venture capitalist. It's been a fun journey and I've got to learn a lot of things along the way.
Tell me, I mean, I was wondering how playing football early in your career and you sort of going through that maybe part of your life has helped you in building a team that, you know, obviously is quite talented and what have you at Syndicate Room.
Yeah, look, the pressure of a startup is very similar to the pressure of an athlete. you know, you have to perform on the day. Nothing ever changes, but in the sense of there's constant pressure to evolve, to get better, to grow, to win. So there's definitely a similarity between the mentalities of an athlete and someone that's working on a startup. And when I was playing, you know, no matter how good one individual was on the team, you know, that might score a goal and fantastic. But if the other team is more organized and pulling in the same direction, if you will, and knows if they're interacting better, if they know what to expect from the other players, a solid team will beat a team that has good players but are less well organized or less well motivated or not in as good of shape. So when I was playing, like, my mentality was always to build the team and, you know, try and lead by example. So in training sessions, like, I never got a bad rap, if you will, but I think some people got annoyed sometimes when I was kind of barking at them to work harder and, you know, put in a shift. And I didn't mind doing that because I knew that it would pay off at the end of the day. But I think some of the guys were there thinking, look, like, yeah, this is fun for me. I want to just come and play, not with my mates, but play, get a little money out of it and look good. And I'm there kind of as this outsider, if you will, who wasn't necessarily the most skillful player. Like, I was a defender. I like to tackle hard. I like to play it simple. And we had some very skillful people on the team. But you know, you might think they're the star players on the team, if you will. But in training, I didn't care about that. It was like, look, if you're not going to work hard, we're not going to win. So I was constantly trying to push people to work harder as a team to, you know, let's do one more set of sprints. Let's do, you know, more of these drills. Let's work on this. And I think that has translated a little bit into the startup, or at least at the start. I've mellowed down a little bit, but I do focus on developing the team more than anything, you know. And I think my role as co-founder is very much to fill in the gaps, to help people do what they need to do. And if I know they may not have the skill or may not have the capacity from a time frame, then I step in. And I don't step in a way of, you can't do this, I'm going to do it. But, you know, quietly in the background, just making sure things are getting done and helping to drive the team on, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it makes complete sense. I mean, I was speaking to a friend and a colleague a few weeks ago, and I said to them, I said, listen, I mean, your team has to be a well-oiled machine. And we drew parallels into the football world. And we looked at the Liverpool team of the 90s and then the Liverpool team of today, which maybe is not, you know, this year hasn't been that great, but, you know, over the last sort of four and a half years.
I think we should stop this conversation because I'm a United supporter. Oh, dear. Frustratingly. But no, I don't mind. I appreciate, you know, I like watching good football. I support United, but I like watching good games. And I actually like the rivalry because I think it gets both teams to perform better. They show up for those games. Sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no. But what you're saying is, you know, if you take a look at the 90s and the Spice Boys and you take a look at Klopp and what he's done, I mean, the structures, drills, all of that stuff was to achieve the outcome of obviously winning the Premier League. And yeah, you were just saying that right now. We need to train hard. We need to drill. And then you've taken that mentality in a way, or some of it, into the startup world, and you're helping your team when they need help, right? Just like, you know, Klopp and others do.
Yeah. And the drills and the well-oiling is good. But as you've seen with Klopp's team right now, you do have to be flexible because eventually the other team or a competitor to a startup, they catch on and they then understand your systems and how you work and they adjust themselves to defend against that, to stop that. And I think that's the thing with Liverpool. Like when Klopp came in, it took him a few years to get his system in. And once that system was in, I'll be honest, like watching Liverpool last year and even the year before, it reminded me of United's best years of fast-paced counterattack football. And it's really hard to defend against. But once you learn how to defend against it, it doesn't work anymore. And this year we've seen that, you know, Liverpool, granted they're missing a few players, they're missing leaders in particular with Van Dijk being out, but the teams know how to defend against their style of play. And so Klopp right now either has to figure out how to change it himself, or unfortunately it might take another manager to come in, change the system, bring in some new surprises and rebuild the team from there. And I guess you could compare that very much to a pivot within a startup. So you've got something, you've drilled it in, it's worked well for a few years, but then you hit a plateau or the competitors catch on and your USP goes away and you've got to figure out how to get to that next level, whether it's a pivot or something else.
And maybe that's a very good analogy, right? And I know you guys at Syndicate Room have been walking through and obviously building the platform and building the business over the last 7.5 odd years. And how's that transpired? I mean, has it worked in phases, just as you described right now? Come in, get the system going, and then build on top of that, see what's happening in the competitors and move forward? Or is it...
Yeah, no. It's definitely been phases, and sometimes the phases are hard to define, whether it's a little blip or something that's lasting that needs a major overhaul. And so, like, you know, when we started, we were a platform in the crowdfunding sense, but for high net worth and sophisticated individuals, where USP was you could come on board and you could see individual opportunities. Angels were leading. And it was that, you know, you as an investor would pick and choose which companies you wanted to go into. And for the first couple of years, that USP was quite strong. People liked the fact that there were smarter people involved, that they could pick and choose the companies. You know, the business was growing well. But then we kind of hit this stage where the, you know, being a two-sided platform, you've got the investors on one side and the companies on the other side. And the companies were saying, actually, we don't like a platform. You know, we liked it at the start when there was hype and there was some marketing value to doing it. But now when we look at it, it takes us, you know, to be honest, 4 to 6 months to raise on the platform. We've got to share everything in a fairly public way. Like, you know, anybody can register and certify and then see what we're up to. And at the end of the day, we could start a campaign and we might be lucky and we might raise $1 million from the platform, or we might get nothing. And then we've spent 4 or 5 months and we've got nothing. And it looks to the outside world like we failed because we couldn't raise from a platform. And yet we actually had a few companies where the angel investors in those rounds were super strong, many multiple X returns on their CV of angel investing. Yet the product or the service that that company was producing didn't resonate with the retail audience. And so, you know, they might have had $1 million from a VC and angels, but then on the crowd side, people were like, I just don't get this. Like, it's too IP protected, too complicated. And so they wouldn't invest on the platform. And that leaves a bad taste in the company's mouth, the angels as well, who brought the company to us. And then we look bad because, you know, we put all this work into raising for this top class company with great investors, but no one wants to come in. So after some period of time with that, what we realized was we had to move away from this platform model and work in a way that was good for both the investors and the companies. And what that was a pivot towards being a fund. It was quite a painful pivot, to be honest, because we had spent 4 years really building up this platform and harping on about how great it was to have a platform where you could pick and choose individual companies and then have to turn around and say, you know what, actually, it's not that great. Like, it was a good idea, but in practice, it wasn't working out how we wanted because the companies weren't interested. The companies that we really wanted to go on the platform weren't necessarily interested in going on it. So it was kind of a, you know, not a kick in the teeth, but it was just like, wow, we spent 4 years building something that had great promise and now we're effectively tearing it down, not tearing it down completely, but we have to go off in this new direction.
That's a big decision, right? I mean, no two ways about it. And how did you guys approach that? Because there's obviously lots of things to consider, but yeah, what steps, maybe we can break it down into steps. What steps did you focus on initially to get going in the new direction?
Well, the biggest realization, maybe not step, well, call it a step if you will, was understanding that our intention of giving people access to the best, quote unquote, best angel opportunities, we weren't actually fulfilling that with the platform because we knew there were good companies telling us no to the platform. And being comfortable admitting that to ourselves was probably the first step. Like, look, you know, we had a business where we had built it to a stage, it was break even. We were still growing. We were at roughly the break-even point. So we had months of break-even and months of not. But on the year, like, you know, total loss, if you will, was negligible. So we had a business model that was working from a revenue perspective. But in our goal to give people access to these best deals, we weren't sure we were hitting that. And so step one was just realizing that. Step two was looking at what assets we had. So what knowledge we had, what tech we had, and seeing if we could shape the business in a way that did meet our goal of getting people into best deals, the ones that were most likely to return higher amounts. And so we spent a lot of time analyzing the data that we had and trying to find new sources of data to find this way that we could do that. And once we harped on to, okay, well, we can't get the platform to work any more efficiently, or, I mean, it could be more efficient, but not to the level that companies want, we realized that we would have to slowly wind it down. And in its place, looking for the new product, it was doing this fund structure, because through a fund, we could move quickly into the companies. Through a fund, we had more standardized terms. We could accept what the companies wanted, not trying to create all the legals that would work for a platform and hundreds of investors and these nominee vehicles that we had to create new ones each time we made an investment. So operationally, a fund made sense. The next step was, though, ensuring that we had a product that people would want and that was different to what was on the market. So that's where we got into the analysis of the UK market as a whole and running the simulations on the last 10 years of data on the startup market and all the growth and where it was coming from, and saying, look, like, these are the trends that we're spotting, and this is how we should build this fund. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the fund now, we do a minimum of 50 companies a year through a fund structure. So it's an annual deployment. A typical fund does kind of 10, maybe 15 at a push. Mm-hmm. So we're doing 50. We're going in earlier because that's when the angels go in. And we've been able to identify which angels are outperforming the market. And we spend a lot of time aligning ourselves to them and making it easy for them to want to work with us. And before, like, we had some great angels bringing deals to the platform, but now we've got this bigger cohort of angels who go, okay, you're going to come into a funding round in 10 days because I'm involved and I'm doing my normal thing. Like, prove it. And we've proved it. Like, we can come in quickly. We're an efficient source of capital. Whereas the platform was this bulky thing that required all these changes and took a lot of time and put companies off. And if they didn't raise, it made everyone upset. Now we've got a fund that it's like, angel brings us a deal. We do a quick review of it, make sure it fits within their pattern, and then we commit. And the first couple of deals we did that way, I think both the angels and the companies were surprised that we actually were able to commit as quickly as we said we would. So yeah, so then launch, last step, launch the new product after you've tested it.
Yeah, I mean, it's logical steps. And I was wondering what tech, assets, and maybe people, what happened in that transformation from phase one to phase two? How did that transpire and play out?
Yeah, that was like the hardest part emotionally. Yeah, we had a team that was about 35 people, I want to say, operating this platform. And when we made the decision to push to the fund, the fund didn't require nearly as many people. And so we had built up a great team doing the platform, wonderful people. And coming to the decision of, we're not going to need half of these people was hard. And who stays? Who are we going to have to give redundancy to? Our CEO, Graham. So when we pivoted, we also looked at the senior team, and my co-founder, Gonzalo, effectively stepped away from the business at that point in time because he had led the platform side of it. And now we were going this new direction, and he realized it wasn't the right thing for him to be leading. So he took a step back, and then he left the business actually to start a new company. But we also had this cohort of employees that we unfortunately had to let go of a fair few of them. And that sucks. Like, it really does. And it wasn't necessarily a monetary only decision. It was just, look, we don't need this many people to run this type of business. We're much more efficient. So we went down initially to, we let go of about half. So we were, I think, 18 people. Effectively over a summer period, we went from 35 to 18. And then not long later, we realized actually it's even more efficient than we thought. We let go of a few more people. I think some of that, though, was like when the pandemic came in and people were working from home and some people were put on furlough for a period of time, we actually realized that we could pick up the slack of the people who were on furlough. Not they were slacking, but the work that they were doing, we could automate, or we could just fit into other people's roles. And so when the first furlough ended, there were a couple of people who didn't come back to work. I don't want to say this is a positive, but we had great people and they've pretty much all found jobs. Like, quite quickly. So I'm proud that for a lot of people, we brought them in as graduates. We helped to train them a bit, and they've gone on to find good jobs. Some of them in investments. Some funny stories there. One person was an investment analyst and then went off to train to be a midwife. It was like, that's quite a change. We had another investment analyst who's gone off to be a policeman. And, you know, like, you kind of laugh about it, but actually, working for us, they had a good time, but then they realized it wasn't their calling and they found what they think may be their calling. So kudos to them.
Yeah, yeah. And very interesting perspective there of how you know, at least work through a problem and create the efficiencies. And obviously, you know, there's things that have to take place in order for you guys to at least move to phase 2.0. What about the knowledge in the firm? Because obviously you're moving, you're pivoting, people are leaving, and maybe some new people are coming. How did you have continuity of that knowledge to make certain that the pivot was a success?
You know, that was part of the decision on who stays and who goes was about that continuity and making sure that as we transitioned, we weren't losing anything. Mm. So that was the biggest thing on keeping the right people in. I think we got a bit lucky that in the new model, like from the technical perspective, a lot of what we had built for the platform made managing a fund quite easy because we were doing high volume of deals, high volume of individual investors into it. So on the tech side, we didn't have to rebuild too much. We had to make some changes and we're constantly keeping the website up to date and design good. But from the database perspective, everything was fairly in place to make the shift. So the tech team were an easy migration to the new model. Hmm. I say easy. There was work to be done, but it was pretty straightforward on what they had to do. On the analyzing investment opportunity side, actually, we were moving to a new way of doing it. Hmm. Because our fund relies on market data, our analysis process for the platform changed a fair bit. We actually made a lot of cuts to the team that was doing the analysis because now it was going to be data-driven. So I think we went from a team of 6 or 7 analysts to 2. So there was a big cut there. And it was more introducing the new way as opposed to having to retain the old way. Mm-hmm. However, on the portfolio management side of it, so the post-investment side of it, we added complication with, okay, we've got some deals that were done via this portfolio way and are managed individually. Mm. Now we've got some that are fund only, and there are some that were portfolio and fund, and having to kind of keep in mind, okay, how do we treat this one? Is it a fund deal? Is it a portfolio deal? It's a portfolio fund deal. Complication is the wrong word, but it just meant that we had to keep that knowledge. Because as much as anyone can look it up in a database, it's much easier when you're speaking to clients and they ask you a question about something if you don't then have to go, okay, let me look this up for you. So we have a few people who are kind of savant-like in their understanding of what deals were done when and what's the latest on them. And those people were obviously very important to the business.
Yeah, and I was wondering, you mentioned introducing the new way. So how do you guys, as the leadership team and, you know, obviously a co-founder in the business, how did you go about introducing that new way to the team?
Yeah, it was very pull. By that, I mean, like, we didn't have to really push people to it because the natural conclusion of the platform was the platform's good, but it's not scalable anymore. Mm. Like, it would take a lot more people. It would take a huge overhaul of process. And even then, we're not sure we could make it work how we want to get into all these deals. And it wasn't just the leadership going, this isn't working. Up and down the line, there were people saying, there's got to be a better way of doing this. From the analysis being done quicker, from getting the deals to investors and being able to close the rounds quicker, to all of that. It was up and down people saying, we can make something better. So from like the product side of it, we did spend a lot of time interviewing investors and companies and, you know, service providers to understand what was out there and really make something that worked. And that process included a lot of people from the various parts of the team. So it wasn't just like myself and Graham and Fran were doing all the legwork on it. It was the analysts were speaking to the companies, you know, investor relations were talking to investors. You know, I was involved and the tech were involved in how it might work from an actual technology side and product presentation side, and the designer was involved in that. So it was a very incorporated or encompassing project. And at the end of it, everyone was agreed that we needed the change and this was how we should change it. So it wasn't like Graham just walked in one day and was like, this is what we're doing. That wouldn't have been good.
So you involved everyone, right? I mean, yeah. It was a team effort.
Absolutely. And I think that's the only way that, maybe not the only way, but that makes a pivot so much easier than someone just coming in and being like, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah. So. And also, I guess it helps build that momentum and also maintain some sort of team spirit.
Absolutely. Like, you know, we're a small team now. We've gone down to 11 people. So we had 18, and then, like I said, there were a few more cuts that we were able to make. I would say everyone, they may not know every little thing that everyone else is doing, but we all know where we're headed. We all know the direction we're going and why we're going there. And everyone has had a say on that. Not that we constantly listen to everyone and make all the changes they suggest, but we do have very open conversations with the wider team on how things are going. And it's a very transparent environment. Not Ray Dalio's radical transparency where you can tell someone you think they're stupid. Like, I don't think we would have that in the team because everyone respects each other. But if someone's got an idea, they speak up. And we give enough platform, if you will, to allow anyone to speak up. So you know, we have a weekly team meeting and anyone can address a concern at that point in time. Everyone gets a little say. They get to almost like a stand-up in a tech team. They can say, this is what I'm working on this week. This is what I did last week. These are the issues I think we're facing. And people are encouraged to do that, which is good because then you don't have surprises.
Exactly. I mean, communication is so important. And as you step through the phase of pivoting, I mean, you mentioned that you went off and you did simulations around understanding to make sure you understand the market correctly. It sounds like, in a way, you're going through a product market fit analysis. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was, we had the product market fit or close to it on the investor side, you know, because we were growing that investor base, but we didn't have it right on the company side. And being this two-sided platform where you have to serve both, if you get one wrong, you know, the business doesn't work. So we spent a lot of time getting it right for the companies. And the biggest thing for the companies, unsurprisingly, was they want to have a quick answer. They don't want to be waiting months to hear back on how much is coming in. If you can work with their terms, great, because then they're not spending money with lawyers, changing things for each individual investor, and things are streamlined. So the efficiency of the capital was their main interest. And you know, for us, we can commit within 10 days, which is faster than many angels can commit, you know, especially now where everything's virtual. Company sends them a deck, angel gets back, then they got to coordinate a time to pitch. Then they do it virtually. And then it's like, okay, well, it's not in person. So we got to do a few more because I'm not sure I fully understand you and the team and get a sense for you. And then I've got to check with people that have already invested to see what you're like to work with. And the process for angels in many ways has been extended because of this pandemic, because it does take longer to get a feel for the people, maybe not the product, but the people when you're doing these virtual meetings. And so for us, you know, if one of our angels comes in and they're doing what they typically do, that's our due diligence on the product market fit for that company. The angel knows what they're doing. Our check is then legal and structurally. And so we do that as quick as we can. And we get back to the company, hey, we're in. They're like, oh, great. You know, like that was easy. Yeah, we did spend a lot of time getting that product market fit right. And as you know, it's constantly improving. Like product market is not a permanent thing. You've got to keep evolving it. And I don't know, that's what keeps it interesting.
Exactly. I mean, how have you done that? I mean, you've gone from platform to fund. You obviously reshaped your team, reshaped your product. How are you continuously going out and evolving and understanding of what the market needs?
Yeah. The credit for all of that goes to the team, by the way. You know, because I'm Graham CEO. I'm kind of, I just call myself co-founder. Like I said, I fill in gaps where they're needed. But I think for me, the big thing is I get to speak to both sides of the platform and to interact with the industry a lot because while I do have day-to-day things, I also have, I'll say free time, but time to explore this and to make connections. So I do spend a fair bit of my time talking to both the companies and investors and other VCs and paying attention to how they're evolving, paying attention to how the needs of both sides of the equation with the companies and the investors is evolving is really important. Like when someone onboards into our fund, we give them direct contact details and the opportunity to chat with us one-to-one. So it's, you know, they're getting my email, they're getting Graham's email, Fran's email. know, they're getting the people that will be supporting them as an investor or company's email, and we actually respond to those. And you know, it's important for us to be that open, because it's not a, you know, if you were a, say, a software as a service business and you charged $5 or $10 a month, like, you've got a customer support team and you need tens of thousands of clients, if you will, to make that work.
Yeah.
But for us, it's a couple hundred investors into the fund, and that's our audience. And because they're putting in larger amounts, like, the average investment ticket into our fund is close to $20K.
Yeah.
So it's worth it for us to be able to be that direct and talk to them. So, you know, I have calls with investors every week, with companies every week, and we send out surveys to investors throughout, probably twice a year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but this is a, it's if we don't want to inundate them constantly on, like, how are things going? We just made one more investment. What do you think?
Yeah.
So they do get these surveys where they can tell us if things are going well or if they're not, and they can call us. You know, they can. They don't have to wait for that. They can pick up the phone and we answer it. So the short version is we keep in contact with the customers on both sides.
And as you moved out of the pivot and into the new business, maybe you can coin that phrase, looking back now, what did you learn the most about the process that you think would be valuable for our listeners, co-founders and CEOs of businesses, to think about?
Yeah, I think hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, exactly.
We definitely caught wind of the model not being as good as we thought it was earlier on. And by that, I mean, you know, the platform was growing and had great growth for like the first 3 years, and then things leveled off. And I think we should have been quicker to address a potential pivot then, because instead of like being open to the pivot, we just thought, okay, we'll add a new product, you know, we'll add on to it, as opposed to stripping away. And the additions didn't really work. Like, we added on trying to let people get involved into IPOs as well as the crowdfunding side of it, because we thought it's a big market and these are investors and IPOs are more liquid, so they'll definitely want it. But the truth was, people were coming to us for these riskier earlier stage investments that looks nothing like an IPO.
Yeah.
Like, on the outside, okay, well, it's investing, but really it was such a different asset class.
Mm.
And what we should have said, instead of trying to think, what can we add? We should have gone, what can we take away to make this more efficient or to really focus it a bit more?
Mm.
And we only really made that decision kind of after spending time and money and frustration trying to add instead of remove. So the advice being, like, don't be afraid to take things away when they're not working, instead of trying to add on to it. The addition often complicates it further and exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, I mean, listen, some great advice there. And I think as you guys are moving forward now into the new 2021, soon it'll be 2022, what question is your team asking of themselves and factors that you're considering to make certain that the pivot is a success and you continuously move on and grow up?
Yeah, I'm going to counter that with, right now, everyone is focused on making the fund as it is work.
Yeah.
And we have a long way to go. So we're at a good point with this fund, but we could probably double, if not treble, the size of this current fund before we looked at what was next. We have some ideas of, you know, potentially doing a next stage fund using similar data, but we don't want to get distracted from making this fund the most that it can be. And that kind of goes back to before, like, we were trying to add things and the platform wasn't working as it should have. And we should have addressed that before trying to add things. So I would say the next, as maybe unambitious as it sounds, the next 2 years are probably just making this fund as good as it can be.
Mm.
We're going to be improving the algorithm on the data assessment. We're going to somehow, if we can, make the process a bit more efficient. Mm. We're going to make the post-investment experience better and try and get the companies. I mean, the companies are great. They've been reporting and doing all of that, but we want to make sure that they don't lose that momentum of reporting and go down the route of investors having to chase them to get reports, because that would reflect poorly on them and us. So we're going to be looking at how we can improve that so that it's easier for the companies to report, and then look at what does the next round look like. So yeah, it's not terribly exciting, but we have a clear path for this fund for at least the next 18 months to 2 years.
Awesome, man. Listen, I think it sounds interesting enough, right? Make it stable, make it work, and also make certain that the right people have the right information. So, you know, it sounds exciting nonetheless, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, it's not huge, crazy new plans, but actually that's not what we need right now. So I am excited for it. 2020 was an interesting year for everyone. 2021 seems to be starting out a bit better. So I'm happy with that.
Cool. And listen, as you know, entrepreneurs and leaders and, you know, people that always want to be learning things, lots of times we listen to podcasts, maybe YouTube channels, and also books. So I wanted to ask you if there's any book that you've read in the past or are currently reading that you think maybe our listeners should pick up and read.
Of course, yeah. So I've got two. One that I read last year, kind of just before the pandemic kicked off, called Atomic Habits, which I've reread twice. Like, it's not terribly long, but it's all about how you create good habits and the science behind it. And the science being, break habits down into these atomic habits so that they don't feel like they're big things. Mm. There's a lot more into it, but I recommend reading that. And then one that I've just read is called Measure What Matters. Mm. Measure What Matters talks about OKRs, the history of it, and how to implement them properly. We've used OKRs before. I think we've done a decent implementation, but actually they're a lot more powerful and there's a lot more you can do with them than we initially thought. So I decided to read this book just to kind of get it in my head of what else we can be doing and should be thinking about with OKRs. I mean, the book's brilliant. So I think anybody who's wanting to learn how to set team goals and also keep people accountable should read this book and consider implementing OKRs into their operation.
Definitely. I mean, I think I'm going to take those books this weekend and start reading them. They sound pretty cool. And listen, as we sign off, how can the listeners get in touch with you and the guys at Syndicate Room?
Yeah. So if you want to do Twitter, by all means, my Twitter is just at Tom Britton. Syndicate Rooms is at Syndicate Room. The website is www.syndicateroom.com. There's a contact us. If you drop us an email, pretty good at responding quickly. So, you know, within kind of one business day, if not sooner. But I do encourage the team all to take their weekends and relax. So if you send us an email over the weekend, apologies, you won't get a response till probably Monday.
Awesome. Yeah, got to have some off time. And listen, Tom, it's been a really cool session. We've dived into how you guys pretty much transformed the business. And I like the analogy of, you know, Liverpool and obviously all the Premier League crowns that we've won in the recent past. But no hard feelings, right? Great having you on the show, mate.
Yeah. We both need to take City down this year, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, I agree. I'm up for it. Yeah, we can get Fergie and Klopp together, right?
That'd be great. Cool. All right, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, cheers, mate.
Bye.